I thought I would try to touch on as many video request topics as I could in this video, including the Phoenicians, Aryans, Israelites and lost tribes, the Ashkenazi, Noah and his sons, and probably the most frequently requested culture, the Scythians. That seems like quite a lot, but since there's a lot of overlap, I'll give it a shot. So welcome to another episode. The Scythians are the common ancestors of the Indo-European people. The word Indo-European describes a language family spoken over the greater part of Europe and Asia as far as northern India. It implies that a tribe of people, the Proto-Indo-Europeans, diffused in the past from the Black Sea area or Anatolia, and identifying these people ethnically and historically will hopefully tie together many loose ends. Proto just means before, original, or first. So Proto-Indo-European means the original tribe of people that spread in antiquity into Europe, to the west, and into India, to the east. And when we look at the branch of anthropology known as linguistics, which means the origin of languages, the oldest branch of Indo-European languages were the Anatolian languages, the geographic area around the Black Sea, including the Caucasus Mountains, which is modern-day Turkey, and Armenia, once part of the Hittite Empire. Pliny the Elder's Natural History derives the name of the Caucasus from the Scythian Croi Cassus, meaning ice shining white with snow. The Caucasus is where we get the term Caucasian from. In a biblical context, it's where Noah was said to have settled after the floodwaters receded. In medieval ethnography, the world was divided into three large-scale groupings, corresponding to three classical continents: the Caucasian Semite people of Asia, the Hamitic Caucasian people of North Africa, and the Caucasian Japhetic people of Europe. While these terms are no longer in use, mainly because of changing demographics, keep in mind that they apply to millennia ago and to the nobility of these societies, not every single individual that lived within a geographical region, which at one time included large slave populations. For now, let's focus on the expansion of the Scythian culture. The Sumerians lived on the steppes north of the Black Sea until they were driven from their homeland by the Scythians, who had themselves been driven from their homeland in Central Asia by a nomadic Massageti, who were also part of the group known as Indo-Europeans, meaning their languages shared the same root words and part of the wider Scythian culture. But these ancient Indo-European tribes were not united. They were constantly at war with each other. It doesn't mean that they were not of the same ethnicity, language group, or race. It just means they fought a lot. So there were also cultural variations among these various sects. For example, according to Herodotus, quote, "The dress and mode of living of the Massageti resembled the Scythians. They fight both on horseback and on foot. Their arms are all either of gold or of brass. Each man has but one wife, yet all the wives are held in common, for this is a custom of the Massageti and not the Scythians. Human life does not come to its natural close with this people. But when a man grows very old, all of his kinsfolk collect together and offer him up in sacrifice, offering at the same time some cattle also. After the sacrifice, they boil the flesh and feast on it, and those who thus end their days are reckoned the happiest. If a man dies of disease, they do not eat him, and bury him in the ground, bewailing his ill fortune that he did not come to be sacrificed. The only god they worship is the sun, and to him they offer the horse in sacrifice." So this Indo-European sect was clearly into sun worship, cannibalism, and sacrifice. Procopius of Caesarea was the principal Byzantine historian of the 6th century, and in his writings called History of the Wars, the Buildings, and the Secret History, states that, quote, "the Massageti, whom they now call Huns." Roman historians also considered the Alans to be the former Massageti. So I know this might be a little confusing, as these tribes are not spoken about in Hollywood films or even in modern classrooms, but it will make more sense later. The 4th century Roman historian Ammianus Marcialis wrote that the Alans were tall, blonde, and, quote, "nearly all of the Alani are men of great stature and beauty. Their hair is somewhat yellow, their eyes are terribly fierce." According to the Jewish historian Josephus, the Alans were Scythians. When we look up the Alans, we find that the name Alan is an Iranian dialectical form of Aryan. Which brings us to another term no longer used in any university after World War II. Yet the word Aryan is etched in stone thousands of years ago in places like the Behistun inscription in Iran and is synonymous with the modern term Indo-European. The Alans, Mesogeti, the Hittites of Anatolia, the Subi, which I covered in a recent video, who became the modern Swedes and occupied southern Germany in what is now called Swabia, and the Scythians, were all Aryan tribes that shared Indo-European or Aryan ancestry. In Histories, Herodotus describes the Budini of Scythia as red-haired and gray-eyed. In the 5th century BC, Greek physician Hippocrates argued that the Scythians were light-skinned. The 2nd century BC Han Chinese envoy Zhang Qian described the Saka, another name for the ethnicity known as the Scythians, as having yellow hair and blue eyes. Pliny the Elder characterizes the Saka, Scythians, or Tocharians as red-haired, blue-eyed, and unusually tall, which is supported by the 4,000-year-old 6-foot-6-inch tall Caucasian mummies found in China. The 4th century bishop Gregory of Nyssa wrote that the Scythians were fair-skinned and blonde-haired. So these tall, ginger and blonde and blue-eyed Aryan tribes from Central Asia and Anatolia, which went by many names, including the Huns, whose ancient symbology included the swastika symbol and serpents, entered Europe in several waves, represented as a great dragon in many European myths and legends, that had an appetite for cattle and young virgins, and in many cases established themselves as royalty and nobility. To help drive this point home, let us take a look at some of the World War I and World War II propaganda from Allied forces about the Germans. Hun, or the Hun, is a term used in reference to the Huns of the migration period. This term was used heavily during World War I and was often seen on Allied war posters. The origin of the term was a reference to Attila the Hun, which in my last video I told you had red hair and blue or green eyes, regardless of the false modern depictions of him. The usage of the term Hun to describe Germans resurfaced during World War II, although less frequently than in the previous war. For example, Winston Churchill in 1941 said in a broadcast speech, quote, "There are less than 70 million malignant Huns, some who are curable and others killable, most of whom are already engaged in holding down Australians, Czechs, Poles, and the many other ancient races they now bully and pillage." Later that year, Churchill referred to the invasion of the Soviet Union as the dull, drilled, docile, brutish masses of the Hun soldiery plodding on like a swarm of crawling locusts. During this time, American President Franklin D. Roosevelt also referred to the German people in this way, saying that an Allied invasion into southern France would surely, quote, "be successful and of great assistance to Eisenhower in driving the Huns from France." So I'm not making any commentary about who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. Since people tend to have their minds already made up, my point is simply that blue-eyed people from the Middle East migrated into Europe, many of whom have ancestors today that have no clue about their own Central Asian or Middle Eastern origins, thinking that they're fair-haired and light-eyed Europeans sprouted out of the ground, the same way that people in modern India think that their upper caste nobility, known as Aryans, were always there and never rode in on their horses, introducing Sanskrit, the swastika, and the ethnic caste system thousands of years ago, which they certainly did. Geneticists, having compared mitochondrial DNA from blue-eyed individuals in diverse countries such as Jordan, Denmark, and Turkey, concluded that people with blue eyes have a single common ancestor that lived by the Black Sea around 8,000 years ago, spreading out from there during the Holocene, along with domesticated animals, agricultural civilization, and the Aryan language family. By the way, this includes many people that do not have blue eyes, but carry the gene for blue eyes recessively. Live Science recently published an article titled "Blue-Eyed Immigrants Transformed Ancient Israel 6,500 Years Ago." The article goes on to say that, quote, "Thousands of years ago in what is now northern Israel, waves of migrating people from the north and east, present-day Iran and Turkey, arrived in the region, and this influx of newcomers had a profound effect, transforming the emerging culture. What's more, these immigrants not only brought new cultural practices, they also introduced new genes, such as the ones that produce blue eyes, that were previously unknown in that geographic area, according to a new study. Archaeologists recently discovered this historic population shift by analyzing DNA from skeletons preserved in an Israeli cave. The site, in the north of the tiny country, contains dozens of burials and more than 600 bodies dating to approximately 6,500 years ago, the scientists reported. DNA analysis showed that the skeletons preserved in the cave were genetically distinct from people who historically lived in that region, and some of the genetic differences matched those of people who lived in neighboring Anatolia and the Zagros Mountains, which are now part of Turkey and Iran, the study found. So what we have is a match between biblical stories about a tribe from the Caucasus Mountains, specifically Mount Ararat, where Noah settled, that saved domesticated animals used in agriculture, and spreading out and disseminating agricultural civilization, horses, cattle, and Aryan languages into Europe and Asia, leaving behind blue-eyed statues that also matches genetic sequencing in terms of blue eyes, as well as a matching fossil record in terms of mummies in modern Israel dating back 6,500 years, 4,000-year-old blonde mummies in China with the same DNA, also matching mummies of Egyptian pharaohs of the same phenotype. So there's absolutely no discrepancy between myth and legends of tall blue-eyed Aryans, properly interpreted biblical accounts, or the genetic or fossil record. In Wikipedia, the stature of the Scythians is recorded as follows, quote, "Anthropological data shows the Scythians were tall and powerfully built, even by modern standards. This was particularly the case for the warrior and nobleman, who were often more than 6 feet tall. Sometimes they exceeded 6'3" in height, and males exceeding 6'6" have been uncovered. The ordinary people whom they dominated were much smaller stature, averaging 4 to 6 inches below them in height. Skeletons of Scythian nobles differ from those of today by their longer arm and leg bones and stronger bone formation. These physical characteristics affirm an Iranian origin. The Scythians also adorn themselves with tattoos. The most famous Scythian mummy is known as the Ice Princess, discovered in an undisturbed tomb from the 5th century BC, a common type of tattoo being griffins, a legendary creature with the body, tail, and back legs of a lion, and the head and wings of an eagle. In regards to what Scythians say about their origins, Herodotus says that, quote, "The Scythians' legend about themselves, which portrays the first Scythian king, Targitus, as the child of the sky god and of a daughter of the Dnieper. Targitus allegedly lived 1,000 years before the failed Persian invasion of Scythia, around 1500 BC. He had 3 sons, before whom fell from the sky a set of 4 golden implements, a plow, a yoke, a cup, and a battle axe. Only the youngest son succeeded in touching the golden implements without them bursting with fire. And this son's descendants, called by Herodotus the royal Scythians, continued to guard them." In another legend, as told by Herodotus, all Scythians were direct descendants of Hercules, who had three sons from a mythical beast whose lower part was snake-like and whose upper part was one of a hermaphrodite. The word hermaphrodite is a combination of the words Hermes and Aphrodite, and has occult interpretations that I've covered in previous videos. The lower serpentine body is similar to the legend of Melusine, which is the goddess used by Starbucks on their logo, which I also covered in a prior episode and will leave a link to in the description. In 2017, another genetic study of the Scythians suggested that the Scythians were related to the Yama culture, also known as the Ochre Grave culture, dating to the Bronze Age around 3300 BC, which derives from its characteristic burial tradition with red ochre. The pits were called Yama. So, as you can see, this area is bordering the north of the Caucasus Mountains, where Mount Ararat is located, and where we find the story of Noah and his three sons, which of course is part of the Hebrew Bible, or Old Testament. And it's interesting that, according to Herodotus, the Scythians did not eat pork, and banned all swine from their territory. That said, let's look at some other names that are attributed to the Scythians. The Encyclopedia Britannica states the term Saka and Scyths were regarded as synonymous. Herodotus wrote that the Persians call all the Scythians Sakai. There are historians that say that the Scythians belonged to the 10 lost tribes of Israel and were allied to what we call the Phoenician Empire, linking the Scythian tribes to the Hebrew patriarch Isaac. According to the Bible, Isaac was the son of Abraham, who was, along with his wife Sarah, the first Israelite to enter the land of Egypt. I can't go into detail regarding the lost tribes now, as that will require several videos to properly cover, but I will say that, archaeologically speaking, there is an ancient city in modern Israel, just north of Jerusalem, that was once called Scythopolis, as you can see here on this map. Which brings us to another name the Scythians were known as, the Askuzai. In Hebrew, the word Ashkenazi means Germans, particularly communities along the Rhine River in western Germany and in northern France dating to the Middle Ages. Their language is Yiddish, which is a form of High German. Swabian is another Aryan language considered High German, which is where New Swabia, or Neuschwabenland in Antarctica, is named after. In the 19th century, the German theologian August Wilhelm Nobel equated Ashkenaz with the Germans, deriving the name of the Asir from Ashkenaz. The Asir are the gods of the principal pantheon in Norse religion, including Odin and Thor. The name Ashkenazi derives from the biblical figure of Ashkenaz, who was the first son of Gomer, son of Japhet, and Japhet was one of the three sons of Noah. Japhet's tribe is considered to be the progenitor of European and, later, East Asian peoples. In other words, Indo-European or Aryans. Japhet is also equated with the Greek titan Iapetos, mentioned by Homer, the ancestor of the Hellenic people, named after Helen of Troy, whose bloodline was considered sacred, which I recently covered in a video about Mary and skull symbology. In the 7th century, Isidore of Seville, who is often regarded as the last scholar of the ancient world, published his noted history, in which he traces the origins of most of the nations of Europe back to Japheth. In Scotland, histories tracing the Scottish people to Japheth were also widely published. I have another video linked in the description about how Scotland got its name. Princess Scotta, ancestor of the Gaels, was also known as Meritaten, a daughter of King Akhenaten and Queen Nefertiti, and sister of King Tut, who were all part of the Hyksos dynasty of Egypt. In Egyptian, Hyksos means foreign rulers, and they introduced the horse, chariot, and bronze medal to the African continent, as well as Aten worship, which is considered the first form of monotheism, meaning the belief in one god, which in this case is symbolized by the sun. Josephus calls them the Shepherd Kings, and anthropologically speaking, they entered Egypt via the Middle East, starting from Anatolia. So now things should start falling into place, as the Scythians were blonde and red-haired and had blue eyes, just like many of the Egyptian statues, and a phenotype common in Scotland and Ireland. The Ashkenazi Jews also predominantly have fair hair and light eyes. In Islamic tradition, 36 languages of the world could be traced back to Japheth, and he's usually regarded as the ancestor of the Gog and Magog tribes, and at times of the Turks, Khazars, Illyrians, Dacians, and Eastern Europeans around the Ukraine. That said, many of the last Scythians were absorbed into what today are called Slavic people, who are also fair-haired with light eyes. The Polish can also claim descent from the ancient Iranian Sarmatians, part of the wider Scythian cultures, making up the dominant Baroque culture and ideology of the nobility that existed in the times of the Renaissance to the 18th centuries, that also extended into Ukraine and Russia, which is why Russian money from pre-communist times boldly bears Aryan symbology prominently in the middle of the currency. As I have stated several times before, the Prophet Muhammad himself had red hair, which brings us to the Khazars. When one looks at a map of Indo-European or Aryan expansions and compares it to a map of the Khazarian Empire, the similarities should speak for itself. The same geographic area attributed to Ashkenazis, as they're ethnically one and the same. I'll also include a link in the description to a prior video I did about the Templars, a German sect that settled Haifa a century before Israel's independence, which today is largely populated by Germanic Ashkenazi people whose ancestors arrived on nationalist socialist ships from 1933 to 1939 in a secret agreement that is historically factual, even if no longer publicized.
I lived in Palestine from 1933 to 1936. And we saw every week transports of German Jews coming to settle in Palestine.
German Jewish settlement of Palestine was, for a time, official Nazi policy. These photos of Jewish life in Palestine, along with a lengthy text, appeared in 1934 in the Berlin paper Der Angriff. A Nazi Visits Palestine was the title of the multi-part series. A medal was struck by Goebbels in commemoration. On one side, the swastika. On the other, the Star of David.
These same Indo-European Aryans, who were the Hyksos pharaohs, were not only linked to the Phoenicians, which means red, but were also the Knights Templar, the people who conducted the Crusades, which were a series of wars by Europeans to recover the Holy Land from Muslims in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, and carved stone churches out of rock in Lalibela, Ethiopia, including swastikas and Star of David, or Steel of Solomon if you prefer, symbols with the Templar cross in the middle of it. It has also been suggested by many authors, such as Sigmund Freud in his book Moses and Monotheism, that Moses was actually born into an Egyptian household rather than being born as a slave and merely raised in the Egyptian royal household, and was himself royalty, with many others also concluding that the noble bloodlines of the biblical Israelites were synonymous with the Hyksos pharaohs, both associated with serpent symbolism, which ties into the legend of St. Patrick, who drove the snakes out of Ireland, since Ireland never had snakes during the entire Holocene, and before that was covered by a mile of ice, so it's clear the snakes represented pagans, which is another way of saying druids. The druids were the Scythian royalty, and this bloodline were also known as dragons, and are symbolically portrayed as a dragon or serpent in many European myths and legends. This dragon symbolism can be seen in Transylvania, where we find Dracula, which translates into dragon, who incidentally Prince Charles claims he's genetically related to. As for the druids, their kings were called Pendragons, as they were in the Middle East, and can be traced back to Anatolia, where they were also the Proto-Sumerian ancestors venerated by the Germanic secret societies, such as the Vril and Thule Society, and who also left mummified remains in China, known as the Tocharians, near massive pyramids in China, which are either ignored or purposely hidden by the communist Chinese government, who know the truth of where their first emperors, swastikas, and dragon symbolism really stems from, not to mention Buddhism itself. This royal bloodline was also known as fairy royalty. So not only were the Druids or dragon kings Scythians from Aryan Anatolia, the same Aryan tribes that introduced the thunder god Thor and his hammer to Europe, which is named after Europa, a Phoenician princess, but also the Saxons or Anglo-Saxons, as well as the Getae, meaning goat in Swedish, which were also the Thracian tribes that once inhabited the regions to either side of the lower Danube in what is today northern Bulgaria and southern Romania, sharing affinities with the Goths, which are the German tribes of northern and eastern Europe, as well as the Guti of Mesopotamia, and becoming the mighty Kush Empire in India. Now let's look at a quote by Lawrence Gardner from his book Realm of the Ringlords, The Myth and Magic of the Grail Quest. Quote, "The Tutha Dedannan were the Black Sea princes of Scythia. Like the original dynastic pharaohs, they traced their descent from the great Pendragons of Mesopotamia. From them sprang the kingly lines of the Irish, Brittany, and the Picts of Scotland, Caledonia. In Wales, they founded the royal house of Gwynedd, while in Cornwall, in the southwest of England, they were the sacred gentry known as Pictsit. So from a single caste of the original blood royal, whether known as the Sangreal, the Albigens, or the Ringlords, we discover many of the descriptive terms which sit at the very heart of popular folklore. For here, in this one noble race, we have the elves, fairies, and pixies, not beguiling little folk, but distinguished kings and queens of the dragon succession." So in closing, I'll remind my subscribers that regardless of any post-World War II propaganda, including films by Steven Spielberg and other Hollywood moguls who are not historians or anthropologists, but globalists with political agenda, the swastika symbol and star known as the Seal of Solomon or David are found side by side in antiquity, such as the archaeological ruins of the Temple of Jupiter in the Phoenician city of Baalbek, which incidentally, Japheth is where we get the modern English spelling for Jupiter, who in Christianity is Saint Peter, the serpent culture stretching from Ireland to India and even deeper into the Far East, Asia, and Japan. But that'll be left for another time when I tie this in with ancient Aryan presence in the New World, which is not really new at all, and whose entire history, as taught in modern academia, has been corrupted and falsified, as America was not named after Amerigo Vespucci, but after Amarica, an Incan word which is literally translated into land of the plumed serpent, another way of saying winged serpent, a symbol etched into the ancient stone of Egypt and Mesopotamia. Thank you for listening. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon. My books make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those who are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your thoughts, so please leave a comment below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon. It looks like it might rain today, so I'm just gonna feed my friends here and cut this intro short. Today's episode will be a continuation on the theme about the Scythians, their ancient origins, and the influence of their lineage on history, which continues until this day. The Merovingian dynasty was the ruling family of the Franks from the middle of the 5th century until 751, the royal bloodline emerging as the King of the Franks, a group of Germanic people whose name was first mentioned in 3rd century Roman sources, but along with other Germanic tribes that I mentioned in my last video, stemmed from Scythians or Aryans that penetrated into Europe from Anatolia. If you haven't seen it yet, I'll leave a link in the description. It's called History of the Royal Dragon Bloodline, and their ancient symbol was the dragon, which comes down to us in legends of invading dragons in European mythology. When we look up the etymology of the word dragon, we find that it says, from Old French dragon, and directly from Latin draconom, or draco, meaning huge serpent, and from Greek drakon, meaning serpent, giant, sea fish. But then it also says it stems from Dirkishtai, to see clearly, and from Proto-Indo-European Dirk, to see. In Sanskrit, visible. In Old Irish, I have seen. Old English and Old High German, light, clear. And Albanian, which linguistically is very close to the original Proto-Indo-European and means light. Then it goes on to say, perhaps in the literal sense, it's the one with the deadly glance. That's interesting, and conjures up the ancient symbol that is most commonly referred to as the evil eye, which is famous all over the Mediterranean since ancient times, spanning much of what has once been the Phoenician Empire, colonies, and trade routes. In Hebrew, dragon translates to tannin, a great sea monster, which brings us back to the Merovingians, whose name is said to derive from Merovi, king of the Franks. According to the legend, Merovi had two fathers, King Clodion and a strange beast of the sea. The Druidic title of Pendragon, which means high dragon or king of kings, was passed on to the Merovingian kings in 666 AD. In Bloodline of the Holy Grail, Lawrence Gardner says, quote, despite the carefully listed genealogies of his time, the heritage of Merovios was strangely obscured in the monastic annals. Although the rightful son of Clodion, he was nonetheless said by historians Priscus to have been sired by an arcane sea creature, the Bisti Neptunus. The Cimbrian Franks, from whose female line the Merovingians emerged, were associated with the Grecian Arcadia before migrating to the Rhineland. As we have seen, they call themselves the Numage, people of the New Covenant, just as the Essenes of Qumran had once been known. It was the Arcadian legacy that was responsible for the mysterious sea beast, the Bisti Neptunus, as symbolically defined in the Merovingian ancestry. The relevant sea lord was King Pallas, a god of old Arcadia. The immortal sea lord was said to be ever incarnate in the dynasty of ancient kings, whose symbol was a fish, as was the traditional symbol of Jesus. This sea creature represents Neptune, the god of the sea in mythology, who is said to have founded Atlantis, which is the pagan version of the pre-flood civilization which God judged in Genesis, and it describes the intermarriage of mankind with the sons of gods. Quote, and it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, and that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men of which were of old, men of renown. It implies that the serpent seed continues after the deluge through Noah's Caucasian descendants, with the serpent being perceived in different ways depending on the civilization, as even Jesus is said to have referred to serpents as wise. The legend of King Merovi seems to conceal the true origins of the Merovingian race in remote antiquity. Merovius derives from the French words mer, meaning sea, and ver, meaning werewolf or dragon. The book of Revelation informs us that the dragon is the devil and Satan. Yet the Hebrew word Satan means an adversary or one who resists. So again, what should be considered is from whose perspective is the story being told. This helps to explain the esoteric allusion to the Merovingians' progenitor, King Merovi, a king of France sired by a mysterious beast of the sea, and the claim that the Merovingian dynasty is of literally satanic descent. In the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the authors tell us, quote, "There are at least a dozen families in Britain and Europe today, with numerous collateral branches, who are of Merovingian lineage. These include the House of Habsburg, Lorraine, Planter, Luxembourg, Montagu, and various others. According to the pre-war documents, the Sinclair family in Britain is also allied to the bloodline, as are various branches of the Stuarts. In many of its documents, the Scion asserts that the new king, in accordance with the Merovingian tradition, would rule but not govern. In other words, he would be a priest king who functions primarily in a ritual and symbolic capacity, and the actual business of governing would be handled by someone else, conceivably by the Priory de Sion. After the Merovingian dynasty was deposed by the Roman Church in 800 AD, their bloodline was preserved by the Imperial and Royal Dragon Court, which conspired to regain control of the Holy Roman Empire through infiltration of church and state. Their insignia was a dragon in the form of a circle and a red cross, the Rosy Cross of the Priory de Sion, the Knights Templar, and the Rosicrucians. King Sigismund of Luxembourg was king of Hungary and Croatia from 1387, king of Germany from 1411, king of Bohemia from 1419, king of Italy from 1431, and Holy Roman Emperor from 1433 until 1437, and the last male member of the House of Luxembourg. When he reconstituted the Imperial and Royal Dragon Court in 1408, called the Societas Draconis, it was based upon the ancient bloodline tradition he had inherited from his presumed Egyptian and Scythian ancestors through the royal house of Vere of Anjou. This line had descended on one side through the Tooth of the Danann, or the Dragon Kings of Anu, who come down to us in myth as a race of fairies, and not in a metaphysical context, but an actual race of people that settled Ireland from around 800 BC, as well as the Black Sea Scythian princes from around modern Ukraine, which I covered in my last video and identified as synonymous with the Aryans, and the Egyptian dragon dynasty of Sobek, who is the crocodile god portrayed as a crocodile-headed man with the headdress of feathers and a sun disk, known as Sukkos in Greek, associated with pharaonic power, fertility, present in the ancient Egyptian pantheon from the Old Kingdom through the Roman period. This Egyptian lineage, incidentally, included the bloodline of the Davidic house of Judah, who married into the Merovingian kings of the Franks. In the book Holy Grail Across the Atlantic, author Michael Bradley says, quote, "There was a very great Jewish component among the Sicumbrian Franks, Merovingians, and because they practiced polygamy, they left a great number of offspring. These aristocratic Merovingian children married into almost all of the noble families of Europe during the 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries. This has prompted more than one historian to suggest that the foundation of European nobility is Jewish." According to Nicholas de Vere, author of The Dragon Legacy, members of the Dragon Court would often wear the insignia of a dragon curved into a circle with a red cross, the same emblem of the original Rosy Cross, which had identified the Grail succession from before 3000 BC. Quote, "It is just possible that in the Merovingians we may have a dynasty of Germanic Hyrcanage, which means army kings or military leaders, derived from an ancient kingly family of the migration period. The princedoms of Vere are actually cultural manifestations of genetic qualities carried in the historical elven blood royal. Established in Angiers in 740 as a royal house arising from far older sacral, regal, Pictish, Scythian Vere origins rooted in antiquity, the House of Vere is recorded in a single name and in an unbroken line for over 1,300 years, and consequently is one of the oldest surviving royal dynasties in Europe. The House of Vere are descended in numerous lines from the Merovingian dynasty and consequently share in this ancient Germanic royal blood tradition. Here's Nicholas de Vere in his own words.
What is the significance of the dragon symbolism, symbolizing, I guess, the origin of this race and the source of the power that it represents? I remember you saying in your book that you can trace that back to the Sumerian figure of Tiamat, the original dragon goddess, or, who sort of represented the chaos out of which the universe was created.
Yeah.
What does it mean to you exactly?
The symbol of the dragon.
Yes, in connection to what you're doing.
Transcendent consciousness.
Okay.
The ability to clear the mind. Let's have a look at the word dragon. The word dragon comes from the Greek edrakon, which is what they call an aorist, or a verb that hasn't got a past, present, or future tense. It's just a verb. Of the word dakesthai, which is a word which simply means to see clearly. Now, that means that the word dragon simply means one who sees clearly. The idea of kingship, or the word, let's have a look at the word king. King means to see clearly. So that, and dragon means to see clearly, so therefore, dragon king is a bit of a tautology, really, because dragon and king are the same thing, or dragon and prince, the first. The symbol of dragon for me represents, firstly, you have that, the serpentine quality of it, which has always been associated with healing, with the spinal column and cerebral cortex and so on. Secondly, as a serpentine figure with wings, it shows that that healing power, or the healing of the mind, has transformed the individual who now has a higher overview of life through clarity than perhaps other people do. And this is why they were chosen as kings, and this is why through social engineering for millennia it was hoped to ensure that that clarity of vision would become hereditary. That's what the symbol means to me.
The stories of your ancestors, the oldest ones, you know, the ones that I guess could be identified with the gods of the ancient world, seems like, and I'm just generalizing a whole lot, because we're talking about different figures from all sorts of different cultures throughout history,
yeah.
But in general we see the same themes in the myths surrounding these figures, that the original race that they came from, the original royal race, is something beyond what we consider to be human now, and that they came from some sort of other world, something that isn't the earth that we know today, that they had some sort of transcendent quality to them that was non-earthly and non-human. Is that correct?
Yes. We are doing research now, Mark Pinkham and I, into the origins of the Anunnaki way back, nearly 40,000 years now, 10,000 years before the hybridization of humanity, to possibly Kashmir. They seem to be linked very, very closely with the sons of Shiva, or the Jats, of whom the main king was Sanat Kumrai, who seems to be the first Grail king in human form, so to speak. The place that Shiva came to Earth, which is very much like the falling to Earth of Lucifer, was in what they now call Shangri-La, with this otherworldly situation. But for our people, we have always been associated with Shangri-La, the Elysian Fields, Arcadia, Tir na n'og, Anwin, which is basically death or the other world.
The Principality of Wales features a red dragon, and we know the British royal family is of Germanic origins. We also see the dragon on the flag of the Qing dynasty, the first national flag of China, as well as the flag of Moscow in the Russian Federation, which shows St. George stabbing a dragon with a golden lance. Of course, there's a dragon on the flag of Bhutan, a Buddhist kingdom on the Himalayas' eastern edge, bordered by Tibet, and known for its monasteries, fortresses, and visits by the Anunnurbe, in the 1930s, the ancestral heritage anthropology branch of the German nationalists, who conducted research into ancient Aryan archaeology around the world, finding archaeological evidence in places like Tibet, as well as the mummies of the Canary Islands, and ultimately linking them to a forgotten global civilization of Atlantis during the Pleistocene, or Ice Age, which settled in Anatolia after a major deluge, and re-established civilization there, spreading out again to other parts of the world as their nobility. That said, it is these Aryan tribes that went by many names, including Scythians, that migrated into Europe in several waves, becoming the Druids, and intermarrying with the royal families and becoming sovereigns, the royal dragon bloodline. The House of Dracul, or Dracula, which means dragon, and that Prince Charles claims direct lineage, descended from Attila the Hun and was established in Central Europe by the sons of Genghis Khan. So the Druid kings were descended from Scythian royalty and later became the Merovingian dynasty, which eventually converted to Christianity. Even after their conversion to Christianity, the Merovingian rulers, like the patriarchs of the Old Testament, were polygamous, particularly with their own bloodline. This ancient use of polygamy in a royal family and occult sex magic is very ancient, as the Scythian line also stretches back into ancient Egypt and ancient Mesopotamia, as this same bloodline was not only that of the pharaohs, but also the Anunnaki, which means those of royal blood, or the serpent seed, or princely noble seed. Which brings us to Robert the Bruce, who was far more than an early Scottish king, but was high-born Merovingian, priest-king of the Celtic Church, liberator of Scotland from England, sovereign Grand Master of the Order of the Knights Templar, and founder of the Order of the Rosy Cross. According to Prince Michael Stuart, author of The Forgotten Monarchy of Scotland, quote, in 1307, under the auspices of Robert the Bruce and the excommunicated clergy, the order was restructured into a church, with a hierarchy quite independent of Rome. The Templar Church had abbots, priests, and even bishops. The knights began to train the army of Robert the Bruce in the hit-and-run tactics of warfare established in the Crusades. The Roman Church may have betrayed the Templars, but in Scotland they found something far more trustworthy and tangible, a sacred royal house and a priest-king of the Celtic Church succession. The King of Scots was installed as a hereditary sovereign Grand Master, and from that time, whichever descending king held that office, he was to be known as Saint Germain. A new order was then formed, called the Elder Brothers of the Rosy Cross, and several of the Rosy Cross knights then sailed to France for a meeting with Pope John XXII at Avignon. Many historians have presumed, therefore, that the Knights Templar must have disbanded in Scotland, but this was not the case. It was simply that Bruce had contrived the secret order to become even more secretive. Indeed, the Order of the Knights of the Rosy Cross had been established by Bruce for Templars who had been valiant at Bannockburn, and this was a very successful cover. The Merovingian dynasty still maintains its legitimacy, and according to members of the organization, will one day openly assert the divine right of their nobility to rule the world as an angelic race of demigods, whose ancestors, they claim, were the fallen angels. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon. My books make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your thoughts, so please don't forget to leave a comment below. Have a great weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.